the Today, of course, which is a local paper, and there is another morning paper, Explorer Examiner, or something like that.
Yeah, there's another one called the Brevard Sentinel, I guess. A local,
I think that's the one, the Sentinel.
The Orlando Sentinel.
Yeah, I see.
So, with regard to what my thoughts are, I guess if I look back, you know, in terms of the launch site activity, one of our, I think, biggest problems has been and will certainly be more evident in the shuttle program, is that we somehow, our management systems and the systems or technical systems that we use, have got a full tile, more detailed advanced planning operation. And I mean right down to the detail. As we envisioned it, other program, you know, to lower our cost, operational cost. In other words, the cost of the program is really not the hardware when it's all said and done. You go through a program and you look at where your money really went, which is go for people. And so forth, but you should have put a telephone. Yeah. So we've just got to minimize the manpower. And of course, to obtain, let's say, not to compromise quality and reliability, which is another trade-off that we have to make. How much the risk can we take in total vis-a-vis the risk that we took in or did not take, let's say, for everything through the management system to support tabletop, to review in-depth redundancy and make corrective action, you know, and also to go into infinite detail and understand the degree of risk that you were taking when you did not look on the side and these sorts of things. So I guess our concern is to not only have the adequate hardware, state-of-the-art hardware, have an easy logistics program as opposed to Apollo hardware that exists today. Business is going out of business, you know, the contractors, many of them, and you have a difficult time getting parts and have to crank up and remanufacture such things. So, in short, we've got to avoid all of those things. Now, back to the thing of advanced planning. In order to obtain the 160-hour turnaround time at the launch site, with all of that work that has to be done through an orbiter, offline plus the online payload activity that has to go into that total configuration in order to turn one around within 150 hours. It says mandatorily that we've got to think out everything we can do that has to be done. A good example in the launch process, we must maximize automation as far as possible. We must take a hard look at level of testing as we did in Apollo. Remember, we went into very minute and detailed testing set out at the onset of the program. And as we gained confidence and experience and were willing to depend on factor checkout and all these other things off-site, then we raised our level of testing to some degree, but not to be compared in that level that we've got to raise it to themselves. We've got to believe we've got an operating system, in other words, and only test that as we must be tested. And I think that has to be as much in an automatic mode as possible, whether it be onboard automation or offline or ground control automation, while we're developing the launch processing system. So it means that we've got to think out detailed test procedures in order to develop our application software for computer controlled systems. Running through the call and call, we never exploit the automation capability of the RCD 1 on this DSC until the call is left. That's when we begin to come up on our curve and test procedures that were automation and brought those into an automatic sense of being, really, and then very rapid change to the total capacity. So the point I'm trying to make, we can't wait for somewhere downstream in Shuttle to believe in these management systems, in our hardware, in our ability to conceive, develop, plan, you know, long-term advanced manner, all that we need, all the total operation systems. In other words, while we'll have a DDT in each phase, all of our planning must be geared to an operational goal. So I guess in summary, I see the launch site of being a victim, if you please, on the one hand, of management systems that are so bureaucratic in the nature that this allows people really to work. You know, the guys that have long-term advanced detail planning must be done by the test engineers. You know, the guys right down there who assist you. You never get your software or are able to evaluate and approve those procedures and plans until they're generated. Well, the programmer can see anything and he knows what he's got to program. So I think that's our big challenge in trying to address management systems that both that detail come into being very early as opposed to the way it
goes. So in other words, you can be at least find a position to decide to be that you didn't do enough. Maybe off the lower level.
That's right. I think some of the detail was overlooked.
Even more than
what we did. Yeah. Gotta start early. And bring everything on the tabletop, you know, earlier than we did before. The detail.
And maybe in the shuttle that's even more important because, of course, there's the operational phase, they need the service phase. It's so much more important than the construction. And also, money-wise, I think they know the shuttle focus on $5 million forward, but this just for building the shuttles. And I hope that we get much more out of it than well, the equivalent of what we have spent in the beginning by getting real good use out of the shuttle. And I have not even seen a real good plan, of course, we have a long-range mission plan, but that again is only about the beginning. Maybe that is what leads these kind of special exercises you just
mentioned. Yes, and then I guess at the other end of the spectrum, the Apollo planning system sort of addressed what we envision to be, if you understand my terminology, a limited longevity of the program. We had a mission to accomplish, and once that was done, we assumed that's the end of that program per se.
In a way, we could have done it just once. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just once would have been good enough. We would have accomplished the basic mission. But the shuttle, that's completely different.
We've got to believe that's going to be here forever.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you look at it in that light, then it says we're going to be flying everybody's payloads. And how we're going to manage that sufficiently to have the timetable for who's doing what and the payloads do. And how do they get integrated into an acceptable plan in terms of schedule in order for the launch site to do this plan, to be ready to accommodate payloads? How's the whole payload world going to be managed?
It almost sounds like you feel, even for the shuttle, there is not enough being done right now. Is that what you want to, at least to express your concern?
Not rapidly enough, with the focus of attention of the focus people, to get on top of that mass.
And
of,
I think I agree with you fully, particularly if you include the payloads. Yeah. It's really...
Well, we have to address the payloads here.
Yeah.
It comes here. Experimenters, and then you'll have some mission and repetitive type hardware like the space lab and the palace and those sorts of things. But how do you bring in, you know, how do you coordinate, manage, do the advanced planning on all of the various types of payloads, whether it's ESRO, ERNO, or whatever, and from whom it is? All of it has to be integrated into a total operating plan, advanced planning, like this. Qualified to be present in the unmanned launch operation. That's a major practice in advanced planning.
And you also have to provide for quite a bit of flexibility because some of the experiments won't be there. others just conked out the day before. Maybe you thought you could refly some from your previous flight and you can for some reason or another. Or maybe you have all of a sudden a high priority item that has to be squeezed into the program.
That's right.
So you really have to provide for this flexibility.
And of course at the launch side, that again becomes evident of, let's say, mass changes or changes that change our way of doing business, which is a new advanced planning, let's say, in the payload world. It says 10 years from now, here are a family of payloads that require 100,000 or 10,000 or 5,000 or 1,000 clean rooms. We need to have general purpose and general purpose procedures that will accommodate the majority of these sorts of things and only address the minimum things through a certain way of doing business and a certain flow of hardware through a set of general purpose facilities we can do as we develop the banking sterilization. We anticipate at that time we start a program in paper. And we even went through the effort to go through the channels to us in Washington. The OSS had no requirement for a certain size airlock door for their payload that they provided for the general landing. But we were able to program and get money for a larger airlock to accommodate a 15 by 65. In other words, my point again is long-term visibility and advanced planning that can minimize costs and allow
That's a good point. And in a way, maybe it's possible that we have gone through the Apollo and Skylab plan. That we really have a base on which to build up our much more complicated long-range plan.
So I guess Phyllis would be my comment.
Okay, you told me you had another meeting at 11:30, and it's practically 11:30 right now. I sure want to thank you, Grady. Maybe I should even make the remark here that I'm interviewing now Dick Gombatz, the Chrysler manager of the launch operations at KSC, in order to give us a contractor's viewpoint on the Apollo program management and the merits and benefits of this management scheme. And here's Dick Gombatz. Are you ready to say something, Dick, or would you like to think for a minute?
Going?
No, just leave it.
Well, I'd like to address myself to the management aspects of the Saturn Apollo program as we've seen them from industry. And I'd like to introduce myself by saying that I have been with North American Aviation with the F-1 program, engine program, from its inception until the first development tests, and then joined Chrysler Corporation specifically for the Saturn 1B program in the operational field. And I'd like to start out by saying that in the development field, particularly as it affected us in the F-1 program, we then at Rocketdyne, North American Aviation, were the first contractor who obtained a large NASA contract in late 1968, only a few months after the agency was established. And when we got into the program, it appeared to us that much more control would be exercised by the government, as we had been used to working on Air Force programs in the ballistic missile program, period. It may be recalled that NASA was not organized at that time to manage large contracts. Heavy reliance was placed on other government, mainly DOD-type contract surveillance people, and the first project manager worked right out of the Washington headquarters of the NASA organization, period. Now, we were concerned because the detailed supervision that we were getting even entered the design and development field. And since an engine developer is by nature concerned about the proprietary interest of his business, this bothered us very considerably in the beginning. However, as we went on, we have to admit that the NASA surveillance turned into a good contract surveillance, which was needed, and fruitful and progressive technical discussion ensued in a better development of the engine. And this was a very large and risky development, the largest rocket engine ever built, more than double the size of a previous development, and was unheard of specifications as far as reliability and performance was concerned. Paragraph. Now I'd like to address myself a little bit to the operations as we've seen them at the Michoud plant and at Huntsville and at the Kennedy Space Center regarding the Saturn 1B stage and also the launch vehicle. Since our operation started at Huntsville first, we were able to establish a good, competent static test crew, which we brought in from the outside, working very close with the NASA operations people who have previously performed these tasks. This went extremely smooth, and it was due to the high degree of cooperation we obtained from NASA that we were able to accomplish all of our static tests with a very small crew. At Cape Kennedy, the picture was almost reversed. Due to the contractual requirements of supporting NASA without having a responsibility, we had to obtain many more people than we originally thought we required to support this effort. We did not believe at that time that the excessive amount of documentation procedures was necessary on a program which was well established. Keep in mind the S1 has flown a number of times before we got into the program. As the mission developed and the upper stages became active and the payload was added, we quickly realized that it was absolutely a requirement to have good and thorough documentation and good management supervision to make this program successful. And I do believe today, in retrospect, when we look at the complete Apollo program from a contractor's point of view, that good management supervision at the highest level, not at the level that normally concerns itself only with the technical details, but at the supervisory level all the way up to the president of the company and the administrator of the agency, has resulted in the success that we had. It is an old axiom, by having management supervision at these levels, that every other manager turns to and does his job. And there's just no other way to do it when you want to be successful in a large program like this. The Skylab mission was a follow-on to the Apollo, and its success was a direct result of the good disciplines and also the knowledge that we obtained working with the government and the contractors to make this successful. We believe that the Apollo-Soyuz operation, which will be based on the same management concept and essentially even with the same people, will be as successful. And we do not plan, from a contractor's point of view, to make many changes, and look forward to a successful flight in 1975. May I add another outstanding feature which certainly contributed to the success of the Apollo program? We had in this nation at the time a real problem in the space program. We've had a lack of success. We were coming out of a small recession. The industry was not at all geared up to a major effort other than the military programs. And direction was given at that time by the President of the United States to achieve a goal. Now, directions have been given before, but this was a very unique goal, in my opinion. When you say that you have to go to the moon and come back, then you really have to do this. You cannot go halfway to the moon and come back halfways. You can't leave one man on the moon because you haven't got the resource to bring him back. It was a program very well defined, as we never had a program defined in the past. And I believe that's probably one of the most unique systems of program definition that I have not seen duplicated since. Now, this particular program then motivated people to the point where they put really their maximum effort into it, making it a success. Failure was very much visible if it had occurred, and success was expected. And it was a directed success program. And I think it was a unique thing. People accused the management, both in industry and government, of being too optimistic. I believe it was necessary to point out that success must be believed and worked to, otherwise it would have never been accomplished. We'd still be driving around with upper stages and dummy payloads today had we not said we were going to be successful from flight to flight. And that motivation has helped to put the program across within the dollar limits as foreseen 10 years earlier.
Why don't we go into the questions the way maybe I should
Okay, we had the same launch vehicle hardware, we had the same launch complexes, we had basically the same GSE, with the exception of some inventory for the payloads, and we had the same people, and we had the same contractor team, and when you put all that together, then it logically falls out that you're going to use most of the same management schemes that you use in the Apollo program, and we did exactly that. We used the configuration control, configuration management schemes and boards and panels and so forth. As you know, we had the same panel structure, we had the same kind of configuration control board, perhaps a little less rigorous, but we still had the same general system. We had the same quality problems and the same kind of plans that we went through. We had in general the same documentation plans. We built document trees for Skylab that followed very closely the Apollo document tree. And as a matter of fact, if you look at KSC's history and program management for Skylab, the people that manned the Skylab program office came from the Apollo program office in general. And sometime later, as a matter of fact, as you recall, the two program offices merged. So we really followed the fundamental precepts of the Apollo management systems almost exactly. Now, what we did try to do different is follow the general concepts without as much detail. We didn't go perhaps into the depth that was done in the Apollo program. The driving force was money. We didn't have the luxury of an unlimited budget, or at least a very large budget that Apollo had. We also did not have, by design and by intent, we did not have a large support contractor in the management systems area. And here I refer to the Boeing TIE effort that you're undoubtedly familiar with. And one way to keep the detail down was not to have as many people to work the details. So we used the skeleton of the system, the fundamental ideas of the system, and just tried to do it with less detail. I'm not readily aware of any areas in which we deviated substantially from the fundamental ideas of the Apollo management systems.
So that also, of course, then answers in a way the question, was the Apollo management system really applicable? You said it was applied,
absolutely.
So apparently it did not create any major problems.
We took various plans that were developed for the Apollo program, went through them and just changed the words and changed the numbers and put a new cover sheet on them and reissued them as Skylab plans because they fit exactly what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And again, that was the economical way to do it. Mm-hmm. Where it didn't meet our intent, then we tried to modify it. But I'm not aware of any major areas where we changed.
From your comments, I took it a little bit, though, that maybe you had some criticism that we had a little bit too much documentation, too much management procedures in the system.
Well,
is that what you wanted to say? And
no,
did we play that down a little bit in Skylab?
I think Apollo had too much for Skylab. Now, that's different than what you're saying.
Yeah.
A little different twist on it. I am not about ready to say that Apollo had too much for Apollo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
After all, we were plowing a lot of new frontiers.
Mm-hmm.
We had to do a lot of formalization and documentation there to get all of the centers and contractors and different pieces of hardware to fit and work together. Now, once having caused that in the Apollo program, I don't think you need it as much in Skylab.
Mm-hmm.
So, first, I don't want to stand judgment about whether Apollo had too much or not enough. I really wasn't that intimately involved. But again, I do think that Apollo had too much for Skylab because we already had
That's
the experience and
yeah.
the understanding to build on, and we didn't need as much formalization in the documentation.
Yeah.
Once you do a job several times, the instruction sheet doesn't have to be as detailed.
Yeah.
And that was the situation I think we found ourselves in.
By the way, I just asked Dick Gombatz the same question, and he said he first thought we had too much documentation in Apollo, but after going through some of the gyrations and in the long run also winding up with some problems with the fins, with stress corrosion, yeah, he felt that it was helpful to have all that documentation.
Well, now, let's talk about it. You're, of course, pinging off operational documentation. I'm talking about management systems. I kind of differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
We found that we could not substantially reduce the formality of the paperwork that controlled operations. When you substantially reduced or reduced to any major extent, you started missing things. You were more prone to letting problems slip by you. So when you talk about procedure writing and the formalization of procedures and inspections and that sort of thing, I think they were nearly as complete and as formal there as they were in the Apollo program. Of course, this is one you should talk to Cappy and those people about. But I was speaking of the kinds of things, the management systems that the program office falls around in which it is the depth of the documentation is not as critical in terms of having a satisfactory operation.
Yeah, that's a good point. And in fact, I hadn't really made this distinction between the two types of documentation, but maybe that's a good point that should be made.
I, having just thought of this point, though, I tend to categorize it as management systems on the one hand and operational documentation on the other.
Yeah. I think most of the gripes were much more with the technical documentation, with the plans and these other details, because normally the contractors did not get too deeply involved in our own management documentation.
True.
Of course, they had to write monthly reports, and sometimes they even griped about the repetitiveness of some of these.
Well, procedures is an example of your point. We had a terribly voluminous procedure library for Skylab because of the number of different modules and the variety of tests that were carried out. It ran into thousands and thousands of pages. And there was discussion and maybe even a tendency at first to try to simplify, that is to, I shouldn't say shortcut, but reduce the amount of detail in this documentation and procedure writing. Turned out not to be a very good idea. You need the detail. You need the rigor, or we needed the rigor in that program. And another thought that comes to mind, Skylab was a one-of-a-kind, one-time through. So there was no learning curve. Now I'm talking payload as opposed to launch vehicle and CSM. So here again, if you were processing 10 ATMs or 10 workshops or airlocks, then perhaps your documentation, even on the operational side, could become less rigorous. And now I'll stick my neck way out and say we talk about in the shuttle era of an airline concept in which you reduce the rigor of the paper and put your trust in the man, well, that assumes a repetitive operation in which you have a learning curve. And we've never had that opportunity in Skylab, not even to the extent that we did in Apollo.
Yeah, that's right.
So in some ways, Skylab looked just like the first Apollo, or the first Saturn 1B, or the first Saturn V.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had all of the learning problems and then never had the opportunity to apply it.
One big difference in Skylab, of course, was also the large number of experiments. Did that warrant or require any change in our documentation?
Well, surprisingly, that isn't fully accurate. If you look back to the Apollo J missions, to the complexity of the experiments in the service module, you find that there was a great deal of similarity between that and the workshop, for example, and also a great deal of similarity in how it had to be done here, in that the experiments originally were supposed to have been completed and integrated back at the plants, having completed their factory acceptance testing and all those good things, and they ran into schedule problems, and it ended up it had to be done here. A lot of the modification had to be done here, a great deal of the integration work had to be done here on Apollo. And that was very similar to what happened to us on Skylab, especially in the EREP experiment area.
Mm-hmm.
EREP being a late starter, as you recall, and that hardware not being able to complete its integration work back at the sites where we'd intended for it to. So we really did a very similar job with a lot of the experiments here for Skylab that we did on the J mission hardware for Apollo.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
You say there were more of them. Yes, there were.
Yeah.
Maybe there were 90 experiments instead of 30 or whatever it was on the J mission, but it was not an order of magnitude in those